out for their own pleasure. When the place is very busy and very materialistic, you don't have a home at all. You have a hell on earth in a house. And this hell on earth drives little children to become emotionally disturbed. It drives teenagers to drugs and delinquency, and it drives the parents up the wall. You know, in God's great plan, we were never designed to live in hell. I'm so glad he thought of that. We were not designed to live in hell. Hell is a place of hatred where there is no love. Now, people worry about the fire. Don't worry about the fire. Worry about the lack of love there and the hatred. That's the tough part of it. See? That's all that hell is, a place where there's no love. We were designed as human beings to live in heaven. And heaven is an eternal place of discovering God and loving him more and more, and discovering each other and loving more and more. So heaven is a place, a community of love. That's what we're meant. That's how we're designed to fit in there. We're meant to be there. So the home has to become a little bit of heaven. There has to be love there. And your congregation, your church, your AA group, this has to be a bigger oasis of love where people can come to warm their hearts and lift their spirits. Because there is no human growth outside of love. You can't grow plants in a closet. Some of our city homes are becoming so, so materialistic and so busy. People come and go. They run in and they run out. They go to this meeting and that meeting. Finally, it's not a home at all. It's something like a self-serve filling station. You know, where you come, you tank up, and you ship out. But there's no togetherness. Belonging to some of our city homes is like belonging to the bus depot or belonging to the telephone book. You're in it, but who gives a damn? You know? People need something to grow. There was a family that moved to Saskatoon to work in the potash industry. There are a few people moving to Saskatchewan now. They used to just get off there when they got off at the wrong place. But now there are actually some that are moving. This family came to Saskatoon, and they couldn't find a house yet, so they were living in a motel. And one day, a visitor came along, and he knew the family well. He sat down, and the little boy knew him, so he got up on his knee. And the visitor felt bad for them that they were still hunting for a house. And he said, "Isn't it too bad? You still don't have a home." And the little boy tugged on his jacket and said, "Oh, yes, we have a home. We just don't have a house to put it in." Now, you notice how the truth comes out of the mouths of children. You buy the house, but you have to put the home into it. And oh, do we need those homes so, so badly. We get so, so terribly materialistic in our province. Oh, dear. In Saskatchewan, I think my only consolation is that I sometimes find Alberta's even worse, you know. Well, I think you can afford it, frankly, you know. In Saskatchewan, we are as materialistic as we can afford. That's the best we can do. Oh, gosh. Last time I was in Edmonton, I said something nasty there. And I don't want you to repeat it to anyone, but I'll tell it to you. I said, I have dedicated my life to comforting the disturbed. And with a bit of free time I have, I like to go about in Edmonton and disturb the comfortable. Anyway, they seem to like that. They understood it. No, in Edmonton, they have the most beautiful symbol of our Canadian materialism. Not just Alberta, but all of Canada, because we're all as materialistic as we can afford. You know, people talk against Alberta. Sometimes it's just because they're jealous. That's all. Don't feel bad about that. But we're all as materialistic as we can afford. But in Edmonton, they have our national symbol there. On a little side street, there's a tiny church, and it has a beautiful neon sign, and the little sign flashes, "Jesus saves, Jesus saves, Jesus saves." Right next door, there's a huge Safeway store, and it has a bigger sign, and the sign flashes, "Safeway saves you more." So, So, you can imagine who has the better business, you know. Oh, dear, we're so, so materialistic. I was lucky. I was raised during the Depression in the 30s, like many of you. And we were lucky. We were so poor, we couldn't afford to be materialistic. So we had to stay home and live as a family. It was beautiful. You know, we had the best softball team for 50 miles in any direction. You know why? We were like the Russians. We practiced winter and summer in the house. It was great, you know? Our house was so old-fashioned, there were even doors and corridors. Would you believe that? And you could close off certain doors. Mother did that, and she barricaded the noise in various areas, and she maintained her sanity in spite of 13 of us. It was lovely. But the typical house, at least in Regina, I'm sure it's different here because you've always been more advanced than we are. But in Regina, the typical house is not designed for a family at all. I think it's designed for a middle-aged couple with a goldfish and a lame poodle. No, but it's not made for a family. The typical house in Regina has no doors, no corridors, the 4-5 level split. No doors, no corridors. Someone burps in the basement here on the 5th level. You hear all sorts of other things that I couldn't talk about in public, you know. Oh, dear. We're so, so materialistic. When we look at the house, at least in Regina, the most beautiful room in the house is the living room. Isn't it a shame? Nobody lives in it. That's where we receive the ladies when they come for tea. That's where we receive the parish priest or the minister, where he drops in every 5 or 6 years. We meet him in the living room. But the children are down behind the furnace. There's a foot of cement all around. They can't hurt anything there. Now, wouldn't it be wonderful for Alcoholics Anonymous during this year of the family, wouldn't it be wonderful to do something special and to offer and create a new trophy, a wonderful trophy for the Mother of the Year in Alberta or even Western Canada? Wouldn't that be something? And give it to the woman who has a special love in her heart, a woman with a lot of fortitude and courage, a lady with enough guts to turn the kids loose in the living room. Imagine if you did it. Imagine if you did it when you got home. if you took the children by the hand and you took them into this strange room and you said, "Children, I would like to introduce you to the living room. It's called the living room, so live in it." Can't you see it? They'd have a ball. They'd swing from the drapes. They'd bounce off the Chesterfield. They'd slide across the coffee table. They'd use the ashtrays as flying saucers. They'd wreck the place. They'd wreck it. Some of your friends would come along. They'd say, "Ye gods, what has happened to the living room? What have you done to the living room?" And you know, some of them would never come back. They'd never come back. But what would you have lost, really? They're not friends. They're furniture inspectors. You know, send them to Sears, Furniture City. There's a lot of good furniture stores in your areas. But if they're real true friends, they won't mind sitting with you down behind the furnace and having a cup of tea. Mind you, you'll have to explain it to your friends. You'll have to say, "Well, you know, it was the year of the family and we decided to do something special. We decided that our children are more precious than our house." Oh, it's true, our house is a bit messy now and then. But gee, the children are in good shape. They love it here. They're always home. They bring their friends. Sometimes there's 52 of them. They're on the refrigerator, the piano, they're all over. And you know, they'll have to cry when they leave home. And that's pretty special nowadays. They'll have to cry. A lot of them don't cry when they leave home, at least in Saskatchewan. Many of them count the days. They say, "Mom and Dad, in 28 days, I'll be 16 years old. I can leave home and you can't bring me back." But ours will cry because they're really leaving something. Don't misunderstand me. I believe in discipline. Discipline is part of a good, loving relationship, and we have to discipline our children. Never be cruel or harsh, but we have to set limits to their behavior. So I don't believe you should let them wreck the house or the furniture, not at all. I believe you have to teach them to respect property and respect people. Mind you, I've been misquoted by the press. Once they ran a little headline which read, "Father Larry believes in dirty houses." You know, sort of give me a home where the buffalo roam and I'll show you a house that Larry likes, you know. Mind you, if you'd visit my place, you'd tend to believe that, you know. You know, we don't vacuum anymore. We just rake. But my philosophy is that houses should be clean enough to be healthy, but they should be messy enough to be happy. They should have a lived-in look. And never be embarrassed or apologize that the children have made a little mess in the house. Oh, dear, we get so concerned with that. I'm embarrassed as a clergyman. I'll visit a home, and Mother gets all uptight because the kids have made a little mess. She says, "Oh, watch out, watch the toys there, Father. Don't sit there." You know, oh, dear. No, unless the poor clergyman is completely blind, let him muddle. You know, he'll find his way. You should never be embarrassed with that. I think anyone should be embarrassed to whose kids are always downtown or they're always in the back alley. They should be embarrassed. Or if they have their baby killed by abortion, I think they could be embarrassed. But you can be proud that you made a home for your children or your grandchildren. You can be proud of that because there's nothing greater that you could do for your God or for your country. The family is the domestic church. It's the basic unit in every congregation, every denomination. It's the very pillar on which society rests. So when we strengthen family life, we do something very, very special for God and for country. What I'm talking about is not something cute or something nice. I'm talking about the very survival of our society. We have to make homes to survive because people are designed by God to live in a community of love. And you know, when you love your children, they can feel it, don't you know? When you love your children, you don't have to line them up every morning like little soldiers and say, "Good morning, children, I love you very much." Let's see, what kind of crap is this? Is mother losing her marbles? You know, it's not how mothers talk. No, all you have to do is to love them and they can feel it. Children have a sixth sense, a special little sense, and they pick up our feelings just like that. It's uncanny. I always say when we communicate with children, we communicate on two channels simultaneously. I call them channel one and channel two. Channel one is the head. With our mouth, we tell children what's in our head. For some of us, it doesn't take long. But the children don't like channel one very much. They distrust it. Sometimes we've given them a bit of hypocrisy or some double talk or outright lies. So they don't like channel one. They love channel two. On channel two, with our feelings, we tell people what's in our heart. Children love channel two, and we love it too. We just don't like to admit it. But channel two is the heart. Children, even when they're retarded, in Red Deer I worked with retarded children, the retarded children pick up our feelings with no trouble at all. It's uncanny. It's true their channel one is a bit weaker. Their channel two is stronger than yours or mine. Schizophrenic children, they're supposed to be psychotic, have poor contact with reality. On channel two, they have antennas a mile long. You can never fool them. I have a schizophrenic girl in our house where I live, and I sometimes try to fool her. I come home and I'm a bit depressed or discouraged, and I don't like to admit it because, you know, she's sick and I shouldn't burden her with my problems. So she comes along and she has a vacant stare as if she's still on the moon. And she comes up to me, she says, "How are you, Father?" And I say, "Well, I'm fine, I'm just a bit tired." She puts her hands on my shoulders and she says, "There's more to it than that, isn't there?" See? She can pick up my feelings just like that. Now, if schizophrenics can do it and retarded people can do it, can you imagine how children do it well? They can pick up our feelings before they can talk. I'm convinced they pick them up before they're born. It's a special sense. You know, we shouldn't be surprised at that. Dogs can do the same. In our homes, we raise poodles to help us make ends meet. If you'd like one, just see me after the talk. We're letting them go for $200. They're lovely, fluffy little things. They don't shed. Anyway, if you were to come to visit us, and I don't recommend that, but if you were to come, and if you love dogs, you could still be out on the sidewalk. Their eyes light up. They wag their tails. They can't wait for you to come into the house. They want to jump in your lap and lick your hand. But if you hate dogs, honestly, you could be out on the sidewalk, the door's closed, their tails go down, they growl and snarl, and they seem to say, "Who's that rotten person that hates dogs? Just bring him in, we'll show him around," you know. Now, if dogs can tell the difference, should we be surprised if children can do the same? They do it much better. I remember working with a little boy. We'll call him Dennis, all right? Because that was his name. And what I'm going to tell you about Dennis is no secret. When he was in grade 4, he went down to the CPR main line, he sawed a padlock, and he threw a switch. He tried to derail the Canadian, the mainline CPR passenger train. Now, this is some 17 years ago, you understand, when the CPR would still have cared. But luckily, they found the switch in time and threw it back, and the train went by as usual. When he was in grade 6, we had a bigger problem. Cars began to disappear. So you'd go for your car in the morning, it would be gone. It was moved 2 or 3 blocks. It was left unharmed. Our paper played it up a lot. They said, "Cars continue to disappear. Police are investigating the phantom swoops again." And it was a mystery until one day, a policeman was driving along and he saw this car coming towards him with apparently no driver in it. Now, you have to have quite a strong background in psychology to understand how absolutely upsetting that is for a policeman. You know, well, yes, they've been conditioned and trained to see a fully licensed driver behind every wheel. But when he got a little closer, he could see this tiny blonde head over the dash. And he stopped the car and arrested Dennis. And he didn't find much wrong with him, except he was trying to get attention. But when they examined the mother, oh, that was a different story. I had occasion to talk to the mother, and a couple of psychiatrists candled her head. Oh, I'm sorry, that's a farming expression. It's what you do to eggs with a bright light. Oh, dear. Oh, yes, in the city you say the doctors did an assessment. That's it. The doctors did an assessment, and they discovered that she never loved Dennis. She rejected him from the word go. Dennis never came to her as a blessing. He came as an accident. But when he was born, she cuddled him a lot. She kissed him a great deal. And he had more toys and more spending money than the average kid on the block. In fact, when I asked her, "Do you love Dennis?" She said, "Well, of course I love Dennis. Look at all I've done for him, all I've given him. How can he do this to us? Of course I love Dennis." You see, she fooled herself, but she never, ever fooled Dennis. He could feel it on Channel 2. There was no love there, nothing but rejection. So he was trying to get some. With all these pranks, moving the cars and all that, he was waving a little flag, really. He was saying, "Hey, hey, you people out there, I'm born already, okay? Will somebody please love me? Anybody, I'm not fussy." You know, that's the first reason why children misbehave, or adults misbehave. You know? When I started in this work, I thought there were 70 or 80,000 reasons why children misbehave. There are only 4. That's why our work is so easy as parents. It's just 4. Number one in the hit parade is to get attention. I've found some who will steal cars, burn buildings. I've even seen some take LSD and some drugs to upset and scare their parents and get their attention. In school, some of the youngsters will even pretend they don't know how to do the work to get attention. I remember how frustrating it was as a teacher. I had just taught the lesson, and little Johnny, who was the smartest kid in class, he'd put up his hand and he'd say, "I don't know how to do it." You could just choke the kid, you know? You felt like saying, "Well, of course you know how to do it, Johnny. I just taught it." And I bet he felt like saying, "Well, of course I know how to do it, stupid. You know, I knew how to do it before you started teaching. You mixed me up a bit, but I got to straighten out again. Yeah. You know? But you know, when I left home this morning, there was nobody home, and you're the first adult I've seen today. Mommy and Daddy were both gone, and I'm so lonesome. If you don't want to teach, just stand there. I don't care, but just be with me." because I'm so lonesome. I know you wouldn't do this in Alberta, but in Saskatchewan, in Regina, if we would open up the classrooms at 8 o'clock in the morning, there would be kids there. And if we'd open them up at 7, there would be children there. I used to think they came to warm their little hands because it's so cold in winter in Regina. But I noticed they do it in winter and they do it in spring and summer too. So they don't come so much to warm their little hands as to warm their tiny hearts. They're so lonesome. And that's the first reason they misbehave. The second reason they misbehave is to get revenge. That's when a child is not taught to love, he learns to hate. And do they hate? Fritz Radl of Detroit has written a book called Children Who Hate. And he gives the inner dynamics, the inner growth of these children who were never loved. And wow, do they hate. These are the youngsters who stab people to death. They burn buildings. They do all sorts of vandalism. In my homes, they're so angry. One of his boys took his hockey skates and chopped up the sink in his bedroom. Another one took a dozen spoons and held them in the carburetor. It didn't help the spoons much or the carburetor. They will smash down a door and kick it to smithereens. In one home, we lost 7 doors in 1 year. Or they'll put their fist through the gyprock. We keep 2 carpenters busy year-round fixing our 7 homes. They're so, so angry. They will punch a pillow and curse and swear at it until there are feathers all over the room. We've had to switch to sponge pillows because of that. 2 of our girls snuck home from school. They broke into one of the homes before the house staff was there. They took a 2x4 and they poked out all the windows, including the picture window. They never missed one. They're so angry. You know, when you see any vandalism in your community, of course you'll know they're from Calgary, but you know, the easy thing would be to say those dirty, rotten teenagers. It would be a much more accurate statement to say, isn't it a sad society that we love them so little that they hate us so much? I won't keep you in suspense. There's only 2 more. The third reason is to get power. They're fed up with the love thing, the attention thing, the revenge thing, and they try for power. You can spot them. You say, Johnny, would you try to take out the garbage? He'll say, try and make me. Would you mind erasing the board? He'll say, what are you going to do about it if I don't? They want to take over. We have to sidestep them judo style, muss up their hair and say, come on, you're going to do it. You can fight with them. You could win the battle, but you lose the war. When children are out for power, you can't work with them there. You have to get them involved in a deep, loving relationship. And the last reason they misbehave is to withdraw. And that's where we see a lot of drug abuse. They give up completely and totally, like the general who surrenders and he pulls his troops off the field. Some of my youngsters withdraw into drugs and they try to stay stoned all the time, or they want to stay drunk all the time because they can't stand the pain. Some of them withdraw onto the highways and hitchhike, not just for a summer, but I know a boy from Alberta, from this province, who started to hitchhike 10 years ago. He's still hitchhiking. He's like a retired tourist at 24. He doesn't live life, he runs from it. We have a girl who's half Indian and half Negro. She was rejected by both sides, and she was abused by the whites. Wow, was she abused by the whites. When we finally got this girl, she was so paranoid, she wouldn't eat. She thought people were out to poison her, so they had to feed her through the veins. We worked with her for 4 years, and we still aren't getting anywhere. She just sits and sits and sits. She has withdrawn into her dream world. She only asks for food and for cigarettes. She sees no point in carrying on a conversation. She sees no purpose in making a friend because she never got any mileage out of it. But the greatest withdrawal of all is suicide. And that's why the number of suicides are going up at such an alarming rate. So you see, there are only 4 reasons why people, but children, misbehave. It's to get attention, to get revenge, to get power, and to withdraw. They're all related to love or the lack of love. And that's why it's so important to have good family life, to really love our children, and then their behavior will improve. Of course, you understand the great crisis is there isn't enough love to go around. Now, when we're short of electricity, we know what to do, don't we? We check the wires that go to the powerhouse. We fix the wires, and the lights go on again, and it's beautiful to be here. When we're short of love, we have to go back to the source, to the powerhouse. And the source of love is God. The scriptures tell us God is love. That's his very essence, his substance. That's the very stuff he's made of, love. Our prayers, our church attendance, these are the wires that connect us with our God. See, that's what it is. So during this year of the family, I would say there is nothing better for you to do than to pray. You must pray every day in your own way. Find your God as you see him or her. I couldn't care less. Find your God and reach him in prayer every day. You've got to fill your heart with him. Then you have love for one another in the family. You have love for your children. You have love to bring to AA. You have love to bring to your congregation or your parish. You have love to bring to the world. And we need it for survival. We need it. I urge you to pray. And don't only think of your own children and your own family. We have so many youngsters today who are just homeless. They have a nice house, but they have no home. They don't belong anywhere. I remember a poor little girl in Regina. She couldn't belong at home. It was a beautiful house, but there was no love there. She couldn't belong in our big school. We had 1,750 students. We had no time for her. You know what she did? She joined a motorcycle gang. And I'll tell you the price she paid to belong. She was a good girl by anybody's standards. You would have loved to have her as a daughter. She didn't believe in premarital sex, didn't believe in drugs. She didn't believe in stealing or lying. When she joined the gang, she paid the price. She had to consent to have intercourse with any of the 18 fellows on demand. Some of them she hated, she despised them, but she did it to belong. She didn't believe in drugs, but she started taking drugs. She pushed and peddled drugs. She didn't believe in stealing, but she started helping the gang with breaking and entering. She did shoplifting for them. And all that she did against her conscience, contrary to her heart. And she would sit in my office and cry her heart out. And I would say to her, well, why don't you get out of the crazy outfit? And one night she tried. And her friend called me at 3 o'clock in the morning. I had to go and pick her up in a back alley. The gang had beaten her black and blue with a bicycle chain. And I thought, well, now she'll come to her senses. Now she'll smarten up. We got her into the car and I said, now, okay, I'll call the police. And you tell the police what they did to you. You charge them. She said, no, I couldn't do that. I said, of course you can. At least get out of the crazy outfit. Can't you see they're wrecking your life? And she looked at me with tears in her eyes and a lot of pain in her face, and she said, well, I've got to belong to something. Of course she does. We all do. We have to belong to a community of love. But it's easier for us adults, don't you see? We can belong to a church, a political party. We can belong to AA. We can belong to a variety of things. If you're a man, at least in my city, you can belong to the Elks, the Lions, the Moose, the Eagles. There's a whole zoo you can belong to if you're a man, you know? But if you're a child, you belong at home, or you try to belong at school, or you're in deep trouble. Let them belong at home. That's what they need to grow. Make strong families for the survival of our society. And think of the ones across the street and down the road. Some of them are so abandoned. Mother Teresa of India has come out to say that the greatest poverty in the world is not in Calcutta or India. It's in North America. It's in the United States and Canada. She maintains that the greatest poverty in the world is not leprosy, and it's not starvation, but the greatest poverty of all is to have been rejected, to have been unwanted and unloved. That's the greatest poverty in the world. And we have a lot of it in Canada. It's right here in Alberta. It's in Saskatchewan. It's all over. I call it cancer of the heart. If Terry Fox were going to run again, I would ask him this time to run for cancer of the heart, the lack of love in our homes. That's the tragedy. So what we really need is love. I urge you to have a big heart for your own children and the ones across the street or down the road, because some of them are so abandoned and so discouraged they have nothing to live for. For some of them, for some of these kids, the whole world is crazy except you, the man they meet on the street or the lady they meet at church. You're different because you care. I don't know if it's because you belong to AA, but you actually care. I can feel your love. And when I'm close to you, I can dig roots and I can grow there. The whole world is mad except you, because you're different. Before I met you, I had nothing to live for. I wanted to die. But now I want to live because I want to become like you. Don't you see? You go ahead. You walk ahead. I'll follow you. You're my shepherd. I'll be your sheep. You go ahead. You know, for a whole lot of them, not just the children, but the elderly and those your own age, there's a whole lot of them that are suffering from emotional malnutrition. Alcohol has to become a painkiller. It has to become a crutch because they can't stand the pain. You have to reach out to them. Now, for many of them, you might be the only gate that blocks them from complete discouragement and despair. You could be the only door that stops them from committing suicide. You know, for many of them, you're the only Bible they'll ever read. Oh, they might flip through the Bible here and there, but it won't change them much. No. How can they believe in God? They hardly believe in people yet. But if you let them close to you, the love and the warmth that they find, the word of God, actually, that they find in your heart and that they see exemplified in your life, that's as close to a Bible as they'll ever get. For many of them, you're the only church they'll ever visit. Or they might be dragged in this church or that, but it won't change them much. But if you could open your heart and let them in, the love and the warmth that they find in the sanctuary of your heart, that's as close to a church as they'll ever visit. For a whole lot of them, I firmly believe that you are the only Christ that they will ever meet. So go ye forth and teach. Teach your children, your family, everyone you meet. Teach them that they're beautiful, that they're precious, that they're lovable, that you're so happy they're there. Teach them that God loves them, that Jesus died for them, surely. But above all, teach them that God loves them through you. God bless. Keep up the wonderful work that you're doing for society, for humanity, for God, and for country. Congratulations, and keep up the good work. I'll pray for you and for your families. I hope you'll pray for me, for my homes, for my children. God bless.
He feels good. Well, we're ready. Prior to the introduction of our guest speaker, an arbutus was telling me at supper, I think I've got this right, but I'd probably make a mistake, that he's on the number one team, or is she on the number one team? Or what are we doing here anyways?